Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 20th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Two Honored in Waterloo for Pulling Unconscious Man from Burning Car by Jeff Reinitz. Rebecca Tucker knew the crash was fresh when she pulled up on it as the sun was rising on April 26th. As she got closer, the Waterloo resident, who was on her way to work at Walmart, noticed a fire flickering under the wrecked Ford Taurus, which had slammed into a concrete overpass support. And she spotted something else. "I thought I saw a head in there," Tucker said. Another motorist, Jody Moore of Cedar Falls, returning from her shift as an intensive care nurse at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, pulled over and rushed over to help Tucker pull on door handles. The trapped driver remained unconscious inside. "I kind of pulled a little harder, and I don't know if he was coming to a bit and unlocked the doors or what, but the door finally opened," Tucker said. With the driver pulled to safety and still incoherent, the two worried someone else was inside the car's smoking interior. "There was a baby seat in the car, so we were concerned there maybe was a child in the vehicle," Moore said. Tucker returned to the car, steeling herself as she heard the fire popping. She stuck her head in for a look to confirm that everyone was out. On Tuesday, the two were honored with Waterloo's Fire Rescues Civilian Commendation Award. Battalion Chief Mike Moore, no relation, said the duo's actions saved the driver's life. "A lot of people don't stop. They call and keep driving. That's the amazing part about this. Two people stopped. The people, the drive-by, and the call and the send us out there, it would have been a much different outcome," Moore said. June 2nd primary plan includes face mask, gloves, and sanitizer by James Q. Lynch. With less than 2 weeks before the June 2nd primary election, county auditors are making sure they have everything necessary for an in-person voting. Poll workers, ballots, pens, and funnels. The funnels will be used when pouring hand sanitizer into spray bottles to keep polling places clean to allay fear of the novel coronavirus. The Iowa Secretary of State Office partnered with the Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management and the Iowa National Guard to deliver 613 funnels, one for each polling place, for local election officials to use when pouring 1,832 gallons of hand sanitizer into 2,452 spray bottles. Protecting voters and poll workers while making sure every eligible Iowan is able to safely vote. Cast a ballot is our goal, Secretary of State Paul Pate said. "We want Iowans who choose to vote in person to know we're taking precautions to reduce the risk of spreading COVID-19. Local election officials also are receiving 130,000 gloves, 68,000 masks, 15,700 face shields manufactured by U.S. Nameplate in Mount Vernon, and 15,000 social distancing floor signs printed by True Art in Iowa City. The supplies are among the steps being taken to protect poll workers and voters who choose to cast in-person ballots from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. June 2nd. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, Pate's office and county election officials are encouraging voters to cast mail-in absentee ballots. To get an absentee ballot, the request form must be received in the county auditor Sheriff's Office by 5 p.m. Friday. More than $500,000 in federal grant money is being provided to counties to help cover the cost of other safety materials, according to the Secretary of State office. That's $300 per precinct, regardless of whether polls in that precinct will be open June 2nd. Auditors can decide how to use those funds. The masks, gloves, and sanitizer are in addition to the $300 per precinct. Linn County requested and received 200 masks for workers, 500 gloves, 48 gallons of hand sanitizer, and a 6-foot social distancing marking stickers. The auditor's office also expects face shields for all poll workers. In addition, the Linn County Auditor's Office bought 5,000 disposable masks for voters. Voters will not be required to use them to vote, but they will be made available to anyone who does not have a mask. It also bought 400 additional gloves, additional signage, spray bottles, microfiber wipes, hand sanitizer bottles, Cedar Ridge hand sanitizer, and painter's tape for 6-foot social distancing marks. The auditors also plan to purchase thermometers for workers to take their own temperatures. In Johnson County, Auditor Travis Weipert received about $17,000 in grant money and has been using that in collaboration with other county offices to obtain supplies of personal protective equipment. In addition to face shields and masks, Weipert has bought bottles of poll workers to wear while at the polls and remove when they leave to go home. He's still trying to stock up on alcohol wipes, but believes he has plenty of spray bottles and towels. Weipert has been working with emergency management and public health on obtaining the personal protective equipment all departments need. A county employee is tracking those expenditures so every department knows how much they will need to reimburse Weipert for those supplies. The public might not see all the behind-the-scenes stuff, but believe me, people are working and working hard on finding the necessary supplies, Weipert said. Help from feds in Iowa. The county auditors have primary responsibility for conducting elections, Pate, however, said. His office worked with the Federal Office of Homeland Security and others to get supplies and materials. We've gotten some federal grant money we have passed on to the counties to help in the cleaning of these sites both during an election and after the election, he explained recently on Iowa PBS, Iowa Press. So there's a full array of services. We've tried to make sure they have. Details of COVID-19 aid to farmers unveiled. The Trump administration unveiled the ground rules Tuesday for distributing $16 billion in direct payments to farmers and ranchers feeling financial pain from COVID-19. But several agriculture groups say producers may need more federal aid in the future. The Agriculture Department will use $9.5 billion provided by Congress to pay farmers and ranchers facing price declines and $6.5 billion from the Commodity Credit Corporation to make direct payments to farmers hurt by market disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. The department also adjusted the limits for payments to individual recipients. The details come a month after Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue broadly outlined a total aid package of up to $16 billion in payments and up to $3 billion in commodity purchases for food banks and other nonprofit organizations. The department has moved ahead with awarding $1.2 billion in contracts for farmers to Families Food Box Purchase Program. President Donald Trump hosted Perdue, several farmers, and American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duval as he announced that sign up at local Farm Service Agency offices for payments will start May 26th. The USDA provided more details in an announcement. The $9.5 billion in payments using funds provided in a March economic relief bill will go to farmers and ranchers hit by price decline of at least 5% from mid-January 2020 to mid-April 2020. Growers of crops such as almonds, sweet corn, strawberries, squash, and other specialty crops can receive payment for crops that shipped from their farms but spoiled because COVID-19 restrictions shut down food service markets. They also can be paid based on harvested crops that did not leave the farm or that had to be destroyed. The $6.5 billion will be used to pay producers affected by COVID-19 market disruptions. Jim Monroe, a spokesman for the National Pork Producers Council, said hog farmers appear likely to receive more aid under the plan than they did in 2018 and 2019, when the USDA distributed more than $23 billion in direct trade aid to compensate farmers for lost foreign markets during trade disputes. Monroe said the industry estimates it will lose $5 billion because pork slaughter and processing plants have closed or slowed work as hundreds of employees have either tested positive for the virus that causes COVID-19 or fallen ill. Hog producers have begun destroying market-ready animals because slaughterhouses are backed up. At the start of this week, more than 116,000 hogs daily could not be harvested for the food supply, Monroe said in a statement. NPPC continues to advocate for solutions to sustain pork producers through a crisis that, without additional government intervention, will likely lead to consolidation and contraction of a highly competitive farm sector. The National Potato Council said the aid for crops like potatoes will not be enough because of a glut of potatoes that has accumulated after a fall in demand from major consumers like restaurants. The resulting oversupply of 1.5 billion pounds of potatoes could fill the U.S. Capitol 14 times over, National Potato Council CEO Cam Quarles said in a statement. Based upon the limited resources available today, after this direct payment program, the potato industry is strongly urging Congress to act rapidly to provide more resources and flexibility to fill this huge gap and maintain producers' livelihood, Quarles said. The USDA will accept applications through August 28th. If approved, applicants will receive 80% of the maximum total payment, with the remaining portion to be paid at a later date. The maximum payment will be $250,000 per person or per entity. Originally, the $250,000 maximum would have favored those who grow crops, but complaints from dairy and livestock groups that they were likely to get less because they raised animals and not crops prompted changes that could allow livestock applicants to receive the higher limit, achieve the higher limit. Applicants that are corporations, limited liability companies, or limited partnerships may receive up to three additional payments of $250,000 if they have three people who meet the definition of actively engaged in providing personal labor or personal management for the farm operation. All applicants must certify they meet the adjusted gross income limit of $900,000 unless they can show that at least 75% of their income comes from farming, ranching, or forestry-related activities. The National Milk Producers Federation, which represents dairy cooperatives, said the aid under the plan would help its members deal with an unprecedented market collapse. But Federation President and CEO Jim Mulhern said the adjustment to payment limits are not enough. We believe more flexibility in payment limits and some changes to payment calculations will be needed in future rounds of funding to meet the unprecedented challenges faced by producers of all sizes in dairy and throughout agriculture, he said in a statement. We look forward to working with federal officials and lawmakers on additional assistance. Kevin Ross, president of the National Corn Growers Association, called it a first step in getting farmers and our customers back on solid footing. Blackhawk County staff to return to work May 26. Buildings could reopen soon, by Amy Rivers. Most county departments will bring their employees back to work next Tuesday and will decide next week whether to reopen to the public June 1st. Members of the Blackhawk County Board of Supervisors voted unanimously to bring back county employees in all departments from paid administrative leave by Tuesday. It looks like most departments are ready to move forward, said Supervisor Dan Trulka, who put forth the motion. Plexiglass shields at public-facing areas have been installed at the Blackhawk County Courthouse and the Pinecrest Building in anticipation of the public's return as coronavirus-related restrictions are lifted, said County Maintenance Superintendent Rory Geving. He said he will be installing yellow signs at entrances to those buildings as well as juvenile court services, instructing people to wear a mask and social distance, as well as placing signs on the floor, keeping people 6 feet apart. Geving's request to buy 20,000 face masks from Fastenal at 64 cents apiece to provide masks for people who come into a county facility without one was pushed to next week's meeting. Geving noted he has about 2,000 on hand at the moment. If they do not have a mask, the guard will supply them with one, Geving said. As the sign says at the entrance, they are available upon request. Plastic face shields are also available to staff per the county's policy, though Geving said he didn't think most employees would have use for them. County Recorder Sandy Smith said she already has asked her staff to come back Wednesday. I thought we discussed last week we were essential, Smith said. We have plenty of work for them to do. That's your choice, Sandy. It's probably a good idea, said Supervisor Tom Little. Board Chair Chris Schwartz agreed with Smith's reopening would be a good model for other county departments to follow. The board agreed to decide whether and when to open to the public at their next meeting on May 26. As the state's campgrounds opened up with no restrictions, County Conservation Director Mike Hendrickson said his park rangers were having trouble explaining to the county's park users why the usage was different. Why is the state park running at 100% campsites and the county parks are running at half? We thought we were all playing by the same rules, Hendrickson said. But he said he was glad to have his parks open and said last weekend netted $8,000 in user fees. Normally, it would be much larger than that, but at least the revenue is starting to come in again, he said. Administrative judge sides with oncoming police chief over Texas termination by Jeff Reinitz. A Texas administrative law judge has determined that Waterloo's oncoming police chief didn't lose his last chief's job because of performance issues. Joel Fitzgerald is scheduled to take the helm of the Waterloo Police Department in June, but he still has a pending whistleblower suit against the city of Fort Worth, where he was the chief of police for several years before he was terminated in 2019. On Friday, Fitzgerald won a legal skirmish when an ALJ with the Texas State Office of Administrative Hearing ruled Fort Worth officials should have filed his departure as an honorable discharge with the State Law Enforcement Commissions instead of a general discharge. Nobody wants a general discharge. It means you had a performance problem and were under an internal affairs investigation, said attorney Stephen Kennedy, who is representing Fitzgerald. When a Texas officer leaves an agency, the agency has to file a report with the Texas Commission of Law Enforcement indicating the nature of the departure, honorable, general, or dishonorable discharge. The report can then be reviewed by other agencies where the officer applies next for employment. Fitzgerald challenged his general discharge, a status reserved for separation related to poor performance or disciplinary investigations. Fort Worth officials argued that Fitzgerald was let go because of lack of judgment, placing his personal interests first, an inability to build relationships and communicate with others, failure to manage the department's budget, and a failure to respond to concerns over the department's use of a federal crime database. City officials also cited a confrontation between Fitzgerald and a Texas Law Enforcement Association official in 2019. The official had earlier removed Fitzgerald from the association, and a confrontation came at a Washington, D.C. Top Cops event to honor bravery and sacrifices in the line of duty. Fitzgerald denied there was a confrontation. He said he was terminated shortly after shortly before he was about to go to FBI officials with information about the city's use of the national database. The administrative law judge ruled that the city didn't formally investigate the top cops incident and failed to show that Fitzgerald used poor judgment at the event. She also sided with Fitzgerald that he should have been given an honorable discharge. The preponderance of the evidence fails to establish that petitioner had a documented performance problem, the administrative law judge wrote in her ruling. Fitzgerald won other decisions, according to Kennedy, including a 2019 Texas Workforce Commission ruling that found no basis to his termination with cause. His civil suit against the city of Fort Worth is still pending. Construction begins on Ashland Avenue in Cedar Falls. Reconstruction will begin on Ashland Avenue from Acorn Lane to Pin Oak Drive. Weather permitting, work will take about 3 weeks, with more time for sod replacement. The roadway will remain open, but may be limited to access on one end. Street parking and sideway access along Ashland may be limited. The contractor will post no parking signs along the street prior to the start of construction, and vehicles will not be relocated out of the impacted driveways. There will likely be a gap of 1 to 2 weeks after curb and gutter repair to allow for curing of the concrete and scheduling of mill and asphalt arrival. Both base and surface pavement will be laid in single days. In both cases, it may be driven on sooner thereafter, but during replacement, no access will be allowed on the street or to driveways. Blackhawk County has highest positive serology tests in the state by Amy Rivers. Blackhawk County has recorded 664 people positive for having had coronavirus through a serology test, the highest in Iowa by far, according to state health officials. A serology test indicates whether a person has produced antibodies for the novel coronavirus, an indicator they've gotten the virus and recovered from it, even if they never showed symptoms. Blackhawk County accounts for nearly 40% of the state's 1,672 total positive serology tests, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The next highest county is Polk County, with 204 positive serology tests. These numbers aren't counted among the county's total number of positive coronavirus cases, said IDPH Director Dr. Caitlin Padotti. They're not included together because they're sort of a different situation, Padotti said at Tuesday's state briefing. But as you might imagine, they're related. Padotti did not elaborate on why the two were different. Blackhawk County has long lumped positive diagnostic tests with positive serology tests, county officials have said, which is why the county said it records a higher number than the state. But adding the state's diagnostic and serology tests together shows nearly 2,300 Blackhawk County residents have had coronavirus, much higher than the county's number. The state of Iowa added 341 cases and 12 deaths to its coronavirus totals Tuesday. Also Tuesday, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said she is considering whether to allow additional services to resume as her current proclamation prohibiting social, community, recreational, leisure, and sporting gatherings and events of more than 10 people expires next week. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And we will continue with today's obituary as soon as I finish this short article. We're continuing to see positive trends, and so we're going to continue to monitor that and look for opportunities to continue to bring more business online, Reynolds said. While Reynolds recently allowed restaurants, fitness centers, malls, hair salons, barbershops, and tanning facilities to reopen with limited limits on close contact and customer volume, she continues the closure for many other businesses. These businesses include bars, casinos, movie theaters, bingo halls, bowling alleys, pool halls, arcades, and amusement parks. Her proclamation expires May 27th. As of Tuesday, the state totals 15,296 known positive cases and 367 deaths. Reynolds also said she will ask the federal government for an extension of the order that allows National Guard troops to assist with state of the coronavirus response missions while being paid with federal funds. An initial extension in the order authorizes their assignment through June, and Reynolds said she plans to seek extension possibly through the end of July. Iowa remains 14th in the nation among all 50 states and the District of Columbia for cases per capita. It remains 24th in deaths per capita. Adding Blackhawk County's totals to the state's 15,556 people in 98 of Iowa's 99 counties have tested positive for coronavirus, or 0.5% of the state's population. Only Decatur County along the Missouri border has no positive cases recorded. There are now 368 deaths in 33 counties, and around 2.4% of Iowans who have tested positive for coronavirus have died, with 87% over the age of 61. The state added one long-term care facility outbreak Tuesday for a total of 37 such outbreaks in 16 counties, with 1,446 cases and 204 of the state's total deaths. Five counties now report an infection rate over 2%, Crawford, Loisa, Marshall, Tama, and Woodbury counties. Another three are over 1% of their population, Blackhawk, Muscatine, and Wapello counties. Nine counties have had 10 or more COVID-19 deaths, Blackhawk, Dallas, Dubuque, Jasper, Lynd, Muscatine, Polk, Tama, and Woodbury counties. The state has a 14.3 positive test rate. The World Health Organization recommends a positive test rate of 10% or less as an adequate testing rate. The Blackhawk County Health Department reported 1,843 cases and 32 deaths in the county as of Monday. The county has four long-term care facility outbreaks. Harmony House added four cases for 89 cases among residents and staff. Friendship Village added three cases for 43 cases. New Aldea landscape remained at 13 cases, and Pillars of the Cedar Valley added one case for a total of 6 cases. Alameda Key County added one case Tuesday for a total of 115 cases and 4 deaths. Bremer County added one case for a total of 65 cases and 5 deaths. An outbreak at Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community comprised 30 of the county's cases. Tama County added 4 cases and 1 death for a total of 362 cases and 18 deaths. The county has 2 long care outbreaks. Pinnacle Estates and of Toledo remains at 52 cases, and Westbrook Acres added 1 case for a total of 32 cases. Winneshiek County added 1 case for a total of 21 cases. Obituaries. Susan Jean Slager Meek, 68, died Friday, May 15th at Vinton Lutheran Home. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, May 23rd, at Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street, Vinton, following social distancing guidelines. Interment will be at Bear Creek Cemetery, rural Vinton. Online condolences at www.phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Cornelia M. Hess, 100, of Waterloo, died Monday, May 18th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital of natural causes. She was born July 15th, 1919, in Middle Amana, daughter of Jacob and Helen Young Riemann. She married Christian Hess May 24th, 1941, in Amana. He died December 1st, 1987. Cornelia was a homemaker. She was a longtime member of Westminster Presbyterian Church. She survived by 2 sons, Lynn, wife Ginger Hess, of Gig Harbor, Washington, and Daryl, wife Laura Hess, of Bettendorf, and 8 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by a son, Donald Hess, a sister, Emmy Hergert, and a brother, Harold Raymond. Private burial will occur at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. A service will be held at a later date. Haggerty, Wyckoff, Gorup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is assisting the family. Memorials to the Friendship Village, Unity Point Hospice, or a memorial of your choice. Online condolences at www.haggertywakeoffgroup.com. She was an avid gardener, reader, collector of Hummel figurines, and loved traveling and shopping. She was an excellent bridge player, enjoyed dominoes, and any type of card game. Sandra K. Sandy Scott, 67, of Waterloo, died Wednesday, May 13th in Waterloo. She was born January 1st, 1953, in Waterloo, daughter of William Francis and Marilyn Helmers Scott. Sandy graduated from West High School in 1971. She worked as a legal secretary for Robert Mason, Robert Rausch, as well as others for short periods. She is survived by her mother of Waterloo, a brother, James Jim, wife Carmel Scott, a brother-in-law, Jeff Shirley, and numerous nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her father, a sister, Kathy Shirley, and a brother, Randy Scott. A private family graveside service will be held at Greenwood Cemetery in Cedar Falls. Arrangements by Kearns Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, Waterloo. Memorials to the family Any cards sent to the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. Sandy loved horses and horse shows. Charles C. Hoover, 68, of Independence, died Saturday, May 16th from an embolic stroke at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Living Center in Cedar Rapids. He was born May 8, 1952, in Independence, son of Charles Raymond Hoover and Evelyn Julia Frank Hoover. He graduated from Independence High School in 1970. In December 1972, he married Deborah Esch. They later divorced. At age 22, Craig began his career at John Deere Waterloo Tractor Works, where he spent the next 30 years until retiring at 52. Craig attended DeVry Institute in Chicago, graduating in 1987. Survivors include his mother of Cedar Rapids, a brother, Jim, whose wife is Sherry Fa Hoover of Vancouver, Washington, a sister, Tammy, and a husband, Alan Pink of Cedar Rapids, a son, Barry Charles, wife, Katie Hoover of Independence, and his grandchildren, Dalton Charles and Blake Ryan Hoover. Services noon Saturday, May 23rd at Wreath Family Center in Independence, where friends may call from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday. Burial at Circle Grove Cemetery in Walker. Memorial to Hoover Wesleyan Church in Walker or the American Legion Independence. Online condolences at www.reeffamilycenter.com. Craig enjoyed boating, water skiing, fishing, helping others fix their cars, and remodeling homes. He also attended University of Iowa football games for many years and was an avid Cubs fan. Carol R. Heath, 74, of Janesville, died Sunday, May 17th at Clarksville Skilled Nursing and Rehab in Clarksville. She was born August 15th, 1945, in Hampton, daughter of Henry and Maxine Hahn Kielman. She graduated from Clarksville High School in 1963. She then graduated from beauty school and worked as a beautician in Cedar Falls, Greene, and the surrounding communities. On January 15, 1984, Carol married Kenneth L. Lee Heath in Clarksville. He died in July 1999. Carol was a custodian for Cedar Falls school system and later UNI. She is survived by four children, Scott, wife Jen Kilman of Clarksville, Michael, wife Karen Lindsay of Gilbertville, Christina, husband Michael Iser of Cedar Falls, and Kurt, wife Jesse Smith Heath of Janesville. Two stepchildren, William Heath of Waverly, and Shelley, husband Darren Clunder of Evansdale. Five grandchildren, Caitlin Iser, Carlene, husband Brian Clark, Tyler, wife Lexi Keeling, Ty, wife Charlotte Lindsay, and Bailey Lindsay. A great-grandson on the way. Three sisters, Lola Volker of Waverly, Joyce, husband Roger Hinders of Clarksville, and Cindy, husband Bruce Hodger of Clarksville. A brother, Kendall, wife Karen Kilman of Clarksville, and many nieces and nephews and cousins. She was preceded in death by her husband Ken, her parents, a granddaughter, Cheyenne Keeling, two brothers, Keith and Jeff Kilman, and sister Bonnie Snow, and a nephew, Trevon Kilman. According to her wishes, Carol's body has been cremated. A public gravesite service with social distancing will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, May 30th at Mount Vernon Township Cemetery, Waterloo. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly is assisting the family. In lieu of flowers, memorials to the family. Online condolences at www.kaisercorson.com. Carol was very social. She loved to visit and had many, many friends. She liked to watch TV, especially the Golden Girls, and an antique roadshow. Play bingo and scratch lottery tickets. She also enjoyed attending Al-Anon meetings. Darlene P. Bronner, 88, of Newton, formerly of Jessup, died on Sunday, May 17th at Park Center. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, May 21st at the Oak Lawn Cemetery in Presco, Iowa. Memorials to the American Lutheran Church in Jessup may be mailed to the Wallace Family Funeral Home and Crematory. Darlene, the daughter of Ted and Evelyn Ratcliffe Gundhus, was born July 2, 1931, in Cresco. She grew up in Cresco and graduated from Cresco High School in 1950. Darlene was united in marriage with Earl Bronner on July 1, 1950. They lived in Waterloo in Denver, Iowa, before making their home in Jessup for many years. Darlene was a homemaker. She was an active member of the American Lutheran Church in Jessup. Darlene is served by her children, Doug, wife Sandy Bronner of Grimes, David, wife Renee Bronner of Cedar Falls, and Amy Rahe, R-A-H-E, of Olwine. Grandchildren, Danabelle Bronner, Trey Bronner, Kennedy Bronner, Olivia Bronner, Sydney Rahe, and Avery Rahe. Her great-grandchild, Xavier, and good friends, Barr and Rose Christensen of Jessup. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband Earl, daughter Deborah Bronner, sister Marcella Crager, and brothers Jimmy and Orville Gunhus. Sports. Sturgis runs golf outing postponed. The Cedar Falls Tiger Booster Club coordinates two major fundraisers in support of Cedar Falls community, school, athletes, and programs. Due to the global pandemic and concerns for the health and welfare of all participants, the Booster Club has reviewed the scheduled summer events. We are grateful for the support of area organizations and patrons who participate in these summer events, said Troy Becker, Cedar Falls Athletic Director. Hopefully, with postponing these events, our community can still have an opportunity to come together in support of Tiger athletes. The 42nd running of the Sturgis Falls Fall Half Marathon and 5K, which is held annually at the Sturgis Fall Weekend, will be postponed until Sunday, July 26th. Run details and registration information can be found on the Booster social media sites and at sturgisfallsruns.com. The 21st annual Pat Mitchell Memorial Golf Outing will be postponed to Thursday, July 30th. This traditional event is hosted at Pheasant Ridge Golf Course in Cedar Falls. Sponsorship and registration information will be made available on the Booster website and social media platforms. The Booster Board wishes to thank many volunteers and parents who coordinate and plan these activities. Membership for the 2020-2021 season will be available starting in June. Former Hawkeye assistant coach dies. Former University of Iowa basketball assistant coach Ken Burmeister died in San Antonio at the age of 72 following a fight with cancer. Burmeister coached 5 seasons at Iowa under head coach Lute Olson, 1979 to 1983. He helped lead the Hawkeyes to 5 NCAA tournaments, including the 1980 Final Four and the 1983 Sweet 16. Burmeister amassed a 311 to 280 5.26 record in 21 seasons as a collegiate head coach at 4 institutions: UT San Antonio 1986 to 1990, Loyola 1994 to 1998, Trinity 1999, and Incarnate Word 2006 to 2018. Dillard's to close Crossroads location by Jeff Ranitz. Another department store is leaving Crossroads Center Mall. Dillard's officials said the departure of its Waterloo location is likely a few months away. "It's really hard to see it go," Jennifer Swarbrick, operations manager for the Waterloo store, who has been there since it opened more than 20 years ago. The store temporarily closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic, as did other Crossroads stores and several non-mall retailers. Swarbrick said the company's decision to permanently close the Crossroads location was based on a number of reasons. "We were actually expecting to open and not have any problems," she said. "A lot of that wasn't just the pandemic. There were other factors that were involved as well." The announcement came after Little Rock, Arkansas-based Dillard's Incorporated reported a fiscal first quarter loss of $162 million on Thursday. The Crossroads store employs about 100 people, and workers can apply for positions at other Dillard's locations. "They will let anyone go anywhere, so they really try to take care of their people," Swarbrick said. The Waterloo store opened at Crossroads in August 1997, constructing its own building attached to the mall instead of leasing. It was the 258th Dillard's store, totaling 155,000 square feet over 2 floors and coinciding with a major renovation at Crossroads, which also brought the mall's elevator. Sumner Man Dead, A Teen Hurt in Fayette County Crash by Jeff Reinitz. One person is dead following a 2-vehicle crash outside Westgate on Monday. According to the Fayette County Sheriff's Office, Kason Thomas Juddish, 18, of Sumner, was driving a 2008 Chevy Impala in the area of W Avenue and 100th Street west of town around 10:44 a.m. when the Impala collided with a 2000 Ford F-350 pickup driven by 53-year-old Thomas William Simmons. Simmons, also of Sumner, died at the scene, and Judish was transported to Gunderson Health Systems in La Crosse, Wisconsin, with serious injuries. The accident remains under investigation. The sheriff's office was assisted by the Iowa State Patrol, Westgate EMS and Fire Department, Owain Mercy Ambulance, Iowa Department of Transportation, and the State Medical Examiner's Office. Suspected cold case killer Baldwin moved to Tennessee. A Waterloo man charged in cold case slayings in other states has been transferred to Tennessee to face murder charges. Authorities moved Clark Perry Baldwin, 58, on Friday from the Blackhawk County Jail in Waterloo to the Maury County Jail in Columbia, Tennessee. Baldwin, a former Nashua resident, is charged with killing Iowa native Pamela Rose Aldrich McCall and her unborn child nearly 30 years ago. McCall, who was born in Cedar Rapids and lived in Virginia, was found dead March 10, 1991, near a highway off-ramp. She was 24 weeks pregnant and had been strangled. Baldwin is also charged in the slaying of two unnamed women in Wyoming. The victims were never identified and were nicknamed Bitter Creek Betty, was found in March 1992 in Sweetwater County, and I-90 Jane Doe was found dead in April 1992 in Sheridan County. Investigators connected Baldwin to the crimes in 2019 after matching DNA from the scenes to DNA in a geology database. He was detained May 6, 2020 in Waterloo and waived extradition. Agents with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation have interviewed Baldwin about the Iowa case, but he hasn't been charged in Iowa. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I am your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.